Today, we're going to start what I think you're going to find to be an exciting, eye-opening, I hope, spirit-filled adventure into the second book of the Torah, Exodus. And Exodus is a wonderful and awesome, visually appealing spectacle. In order to set the table for our study, to get a sense of where it's going to take us, I'd like to spend a little bit of time giving you an overview of Exodus, talking a little about the conditions that Israel lived under during the time between Joseph's death and the first mention of Moses. The Hebrew name for the section of the Torah that we call Exodus is Shmot, and Shmot means names, and it comes from the fact that the first words of the book begin with, these are the names, the Shmot, of the sons of Israel, Bnei Israel. Now, just as a quick refresher, the first five books of the Bible are in Hebrew Torah. Torah means teaching or instruction. It does not mean law. The Torah, consisting of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, is essentially traditions that are handed down orally from generation to generation that are purportedly what God gave to Moses on the holy mountain that we call Mount Sinai. Eventually, what began as oral traditions were written down on papyrus scrolls sometime before the first king of Israel, Saul, was anointed. Now, Genesis is often called the book of beginnings. That's beginnings ending with an S, plural. Several beginnings. In Genesis, it's my opinion that we are not really so much told of the beginning of the universe, that is, that time when an incalculably vast nothing became something, but rather it seems to me that the start of Genesis is about God creating the conditions for life. That's what's valuable to God, life. In other words, the creation account begins by stating that it was God who created everything and then explains that the earth was formless and void, meaning it had been created, but it had been sitting there for some unspecified amount of time, as with the rest of the universe. And then we're told that the darkness was over the surface of the deep, so there was already a deep. And lastly, that the Spirit of God was moving over that surface of the waters. So what we see is that the creation story is about the beginning of the physical environment that could support life. But it was only the first of several beginnings that we would be told about in Genesis. Now, Exodus, Shmot, is in many ways another book of beginnings. It is the book of beginnings of a new nation of people who God elected and separated from all other people on planet Earth, the Israelites. And Yehovah established this set-apart nation on political and civil and religious levels. In other words, although the earth and the stars and animals and plants and mankind were all created in the earliest part of the creation story, God had not yet finished developing his divine work with these infants of creation. He didn't create and then just let everything evolve on its own without his further molding and shaping. Exodus is entirely God-centered. And Exodus establishes several important understandings about the nature of the Lord, most of which we are expected to already have digested, certainly as a prelude to studying the New Testament, we should know all this. In Exodus, we learn that there is but one God. His name is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. And that he is the same God that appeared to the patriarchs as El Shaddai. He is the creator of all things, but he is also above and not organically part of the things that he created. He is present and he is near. But his being and essence is not of the same substance as any created thing, except in small part for mankind. This God of Abraham is different than any of the pagan mystery Babylon gods. His area of dominion is infinite. His sphere of influence is without boundaries and limitations. His powers are infinite, and yet he constantly interacts with mere humans. In other words, the God of Israel is deeply involved in everyday human affairs, and in fact uses human affairs to achieve a much grander purpose. His grand plan involves the establishment of a nation of people that he will rescue, redeem, teach, nurture, and discipline. And that is Israel. So although Israel, as created in Genesis, is a separate and identifiable people group, it was, at the time of the last words written in the book of Genesis, still a fairly primitive form. God had done little yet to create that peculiar order of society that would make Israel appear separate and distinct from all others. And about the only thing that made them visibly different from the Egyptians was race and vocation. They were mainly Semitic shepherds, while the Egyptians were cattle ranchers and building constructors who came from the line of Ham. Exodus is the section of the Bible where we see another division, election, and separation take place. Israel advances from infancy to adolescence and then grows into a nation of people, maturing from only a group of people. It's become a nation with its own cultures, its own laws, well-defined morals and ethics. It's created its own history. It possesses its own land. It has its own God who establishes the unchangeable morals and ethics and justice system that Israel is to live their lives by. We will, early in Exodus, be introduced to the principle of Passover. How about that for timing? Yes, Passover is a divine principle, far more than it is merely a holiday to observe. The first Passover was that great and dreadful night when God sent the final plague upon Egypt that caused Pharaoh to loosen his grip on God's people. And it was that plague that resulted in the deaths of every firstborn child all throughout Egypt. However, for those who followed God's instruction to paint the doorposts of their homes with the blood of the lamb, death passed by. That is, all of Egypt was placed under the death penalty for their rebellion against God and for impeding God's people. But God made provision to exempt those who trusted him from that death penalty. And that provision was by the means of the blood that was spilled from an innocent lamb. And by that blood alone could they be delivered. Here in Exodus, we could not have a more perfect picture in the entire Bible for the purpose of the future Messiah, Yeshua, Jesus the Christ. Now in Exodus, we will also be introduced to a new covenant. Now if you're paying attention to what I just said, your ears should be perking up saying, what? What did he say? Exodus brings us a new covenant? You see, terminology has an enormous impact on the way we perceive new information that's given to us. We have typically been taught that the Bible is based on two main divisions called the Old Testament and the New Testament. Most everything in Christianity is based on the premise that there was an original set of rules and laws handed down to mankind by God, which was eventually replaced by a new and better set of rules called the New Testament. And for Gentile Christians, it has been heavily implied that there is little point to knowing any more about the Bible than we can find in the New Testament. So the Old Testament is seen as more ancient history, maybe a curiosity. fit only for scholars, for academics, or perhaps the source of some interesting Sunday school stories for children. Or it's for people with a lot of time on their hands. Now, those of you who graduated from dissecting the book of Genesis, hopefully, are beginning to appreciate that most of the spiritual principles that we tend to ascribe as originating in the New Testament were already in operation. And we've already found them there in the oldest book of the Old Testament, Genesis. The point's this. We really need to relegate the terms, if we could, Old Testament and New Testament to the waste bin of our vocabulary. We have a Bible, one unified work of God, the Word. And just as God is one, echad, so are our scriptures. Take away the Old Testament, we have half a Bible. Take away the New Testament, we have half a Bible. And when we take away either half, it's not that we lose half the understanding. It's that most, if not all, of what we think we know is actually quite incomplete and skewed. Let me also make the point that the New Covenant and the New Testament are not the same things. The New Covenant is proclaimed in the Old Testament in Jeremiah 31. The New Covenant is a prophecy of yet another series of covenants that God would make with Israel. Each covenant is necessary and it's important, and each covenant is still valid. The New Testament simply records that the New Covenant, as foretold in Jeremiah, came about, and that Yeshua ben Yosef, Jesus son of Joseph, is the Messiah who brings in the New Covenant by means of spilling his atoning blood for our sakes. Indeed, we will see in Exodus that God also gives Moses a new covenant, not the same covenant as what we call the New Covenant, but it was for Moses the latest of a series of covenants that the Lord established to bring about his will. The covenant given on Mount Sinai is that which Christians typically call the Ten Commandments or the Law. Yet it consists, as we're going to see in the weeks ahead, of far more than 10 basic laws of God. Now, what we will also be introduced to in this newest covenant given to Moses is a new type of a covenant, a conditional covenant, a covenant that's bilateral, a covenant that's based on humans as well as on God, each doing their part. A covenant that is mutual between God and mankind. This is entirely different than the covenant God made with Abraham some 600 years earlier. Because for that covenant, which led to the establishment of what the Bible calls the line of covenant promise, that covenant was unconditional. That covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was unilateral. It was one way, not mutual. It all depended on God. Nothing man could do could cause God to pull back from that covenant nor to change it. In other words, the earlier covenants were promises. The earlier covenant was a promise from God to Abraham. Now, this new covenant given to Moses on Mount Sinai in no way replaced the entirely different and older covenant given to Abraham. It was not a newer and better model with all the latest bells and whistles designed to replace the older, outdated one. It was simply another covenant, uniquely distinct in its purpose and in its nature from the one that was given to Abraham. Yet, just as the first half of the Bible is the foundation for the second, so is Abraham's covenant the foundation for this new one that will be given to Moses. Therefore, the covenants of Abraham and Moses are very different, but they're tightly connected, as are the chapters of a book. Now, Exodus is a saga. It's a wide canvas painted with broad strokes. Yet we must not think of it like a secular history lesson. Only events and mental pictures that illustrate and demonstrate divine principles and purposes, that's what's recorded for our study. Therefore, Exodus doesn't give us a great deal of details on happenings and places and people and all about all the cultures that are involved. It doesn't describe the magnificent and advanced society of Egypt. It doesn't tell us much about Israel's time there. It doesn't give us precise information on the route of the Exodus. It doesn't tell us much about the Pharaoh of the Exodus, except for some explicit instructions on the building of the wilderness tabernacle and the accompanying rituals. Details are actually in very short supply in Exodus. From the time of the close of the last chapter of Genesis to the beginning of the book of Exodus, we take a leap in time, about 350 years. So from the last word of Genesis to the first word of Exodus, 350 years have passed, silently, as though it didn't really suit God to even bother to tell us much about what went on in Egypt. Or it's as though God just forgot about poor old Israel, languishing away in this heat as forced labor that had become their lot. And no doubt the majority of those Hebrews must have felt that God had abandoned them. Now, what I think you will come to see, however, is that what God did with Israel was to, metaphorically speaking, make a cake. God carefully selected the ingredients to make Israel. Then he mixed them until they were properly blended, and then he set the mixture in an oven to be baked. He set his heavenly timer for exactly the amount of time he knew was needed for this Hebrew cake to congeal and then to rise and become usable, 400 years. And he waited. And although he undoubtedly monitored the baking process in general, there was no need for substantial intervention on his part. The cake would remain in the oven until the timer went off and it was finished baking. Well, when God opened the oven, out popped Israel. Apparently, there was a little point in his telling us all the details of what went on during the time Israel was baking in the oven of Egypt. So the Bible contains practically nothing of those years. Now, the Torah presents us essentially, then, with a pair of bookends, with the volumes of information and history that lay in between those bookends missing concerning what apparently was one of the most, if not the most, important purpose for God's determination that Israel would indeed spend a long time in Egypt. The first bookend is Genesis 46:3, because there God tells Jacob, "Fear not to go down to Egypt, for I will make there of thee a great nation." And that single bookend stands alone until the next one appears shortly after the opening verses of Exodus. "And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them." There's your two bookends. God prophesied Israel's expansive population group, declared it was going to happen, and it happened. Now, how it all happened may be of interest to us, but God's only mission was to ensure that his divine purposes were fulfilled, not that posterity should have a blow-by-blow account of it all, or an explanation of all the hows and whys. Perhaps some of the Israelites remembered that God had told their forefather, Abraham, later on Jacob, that Egypt was going to be their destiny for a time. Perhaps they reckoned that just as the prediction of their sojourn in Egypt and their population explosion had come true, So it would happen at God's appointed time that, as promised in Genesis 46:4, I will surely bring you back up again. Yet after 3.5 centuries in Egypt with apparently very little input from God, how much would those Hebrews actually have remembered about those precious and reassuring promises given their ongoing condition as slave laborers? And more importantly, how much would they still trust in the one who made those now distant promises? Trust him during a time while they lived amidst a culture that deified and worshiped beasts and men and the sun and the moon and the stars. A culture that was completely preoccupied with life after death. They knew nothing of God. This death culture of Egypt was probably one of the reasons that we see such a reticence on the part of the Torah to even discuss death and the afterlife. The Old Testament never introduces the concept of dying and going to heaven. In fact, what happens after death is barely touched upon in the Old Testament. Gives us the haziest of pictures when it does. Egypt's religion was one of magnificent monuments and god images, and it's one that focused on death. The pyramids were just elaborate burial chambers, self-contained kingdoms for living a comfortable afterlife. Therefore, Israel's religion became an imageless one. And the only authorized monument we'll find in Exodus was a modest tent structure built for God to dwell in alongside his people. And as for the subject of death itself, it was simply dealt with as little more than a mysterious fact and unavoidable fate for everybody. Now, unfortunately for us, Exodus opens by immediately cutting to the chase, telling us only in the broadest terms the condition of the Hebrews in Egypt. In shorthand fashion, the verses of chapter 1 set the stage for God's upcoming battle with Pharaoh through Moses. But there are other sources of information of historical importance that do exist about the Israelites' time in Egypt, that is, sources other than the Bible. And we will explore several items of interest that makes use of this information, including the elusive route of the Exodus, the location of Mount Sinai, the site of the Red Sea crossing, and several more things. Now, to best understand the book of Exodus and to comprehend not just what it says, but what it means in relation to the overall scriptural picture, we need to be able to stand back and look at it from a structural standpoint. See, because there are themes and patterns and there's logical divisions that emerge, and they all work together to give us a good understanding of the formation and the maturing of Israel as a nation of people. Now, understanding that the contents of Exodus is critical to understanding everything that will follow in the Bible is what I want you to gather from today's introduction. Now, the noted Bible scholar, Everett Fox, see 6 divisions within the book of Exodus. Now, I want to say from the outset that just as the standard biblical divisions of Old Testament and New Testament, the 66 name books, all the numbered chapters and verses, that these are entirely man-made and of no spiritual importance, so is this concept of 6 divisions within the book of Exodus. It's all somewhat arbitrary. The purpose of all these divisions is only to give our finite little brains a way to deal with the sheer volume of Holy Scripture. What is it they say about how you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. And it's a more efficient way to communicate amongst ourselves concerning specific Bible passages as we study and discuss and we search out God's Word. So according to Everett Fox's method, he sees Exodus's opening division, which is the first of 6, as what he calls the deliverance narrative. That is, God redeems his chosen people, Israel. And these first few chapters are going to review the circumstances and the methods that God used, primarily through Moses and Pharaoh, that would allow this now enormous nation of the Hebrews to leave Egypt at a time when that's the last thing that Pharaoh wanted to see occur. Because Pharaoh well knew that Israel leaving Egypt, well, that would be a devastating blow to his nation. Division two he calls the wilderness experience. It deals with the experiences of Israel as a displaced horde of refugees trekking across a barren wasteland immediately following their escape from Egypt. It is the beginning period when God would show Israel who he is, that he is trustworthy, he is holy, and that he is just, but he's also not to be trifled with. It would end with him showing who they are in his sight as they march away from who they used to be in Egypt. This leads to division three, covenant and law, which is more correctly called Torah, whereby God starts to deal with the structure of Israel itself, particularly societal and religious structure. In Egypt, you see, Israel was just an appendage of Egypt. However, now they experience that first great governing dynamic of God that we discussed about a year ago. Division, separation, and election. Israel was in the process of being divided and separated and molded into a nation built in God's image and set apart for service to him. By means of God giving Moses the Torah, he also effectively gave Israel a manual for living, a manual for living as a redeemed people, a manual for living in harmony with him. No guesswork was going to be needed. Following along with the biblical theme of structure, Division 4 moves to instructions, blueprints, really, if you would. And the blueprints are for the building of a structure and the setting up of a priesthood for service in that structure so that God would tabernacle, would dwell among his chosen people. And that building is what we call the wilderness tabernacle. Now, since the wilderness tabernacle is just a physical model of a spiritual and heavenly place that would be followed hundreds of years later with a temple, we will be spending quite some time exploring the design of the tabernacle and all the symbolism behind the God-ordained rituals that the priests would perform there. Both the design and the rituals are prophetic as well as symbolic learning devices. And learning about the tabernacle service is going to help us understand much that is hidden from us in the New Testament if we don't first understand the meaning of the tabernacle and its services. This reality particularly applies, by the way, to the book of Revelation. Next, after God has put forth his divinely ordered structure, Division 5 shows mankind responding by implementing their own structure, just the way one would expect a fallen race's concept of structure might proceed. What do they construct? A golden calf. In doing so, they are trying, either consciously or subconsciously, to return to their old and familiar ways in Egypt. And what follows is the terrible consequences of what happens when man rebels against God's system of order, engage in idolatry, and how God provides a much-needed pathway for reconciliation when man sins and rebels against just such a God. The division of Exodus Mr. Fox calls, appropriately enough, infidelity and reconciliation. Now, the sixth and final division of Exodus concerns the actual construction of the wilderness tabernacle and then God's inhabitation of that divine structure. Now, I don't think that Everett Fox intended to make any analogies by means of the way that he, I think appropriately, divided up Exodus, but it does provide us with a useful tool to look at how God works. It helps us to visualize patterns that God develops and uses throughout the Bible. And we see this same God pattern emerge in our own personal lives as believers. Deliverance, wilderness experience, receiving the covenant and law, the living word of God, preparing the tabernacle, us, that God, the Holy Spirit, might dwell within us, our inevitable infidelity against God due to the evil inclinations that are still part of who we are, and then his gracious provision for reconciliation. And then finally, the completion and perfection of the tabernacle that is yet future to us. But beyond this structure of Exodus, there are also certain words that God uses, which gives a beautiful unity to it all. Sadly, most of our modern English Bibles mask this unity to varying degrees, because these words are of Hebrew origin, and the way Hebrew words are used is quite different from English. We're going to find throughout Exodus the recurrence of the words in English, see, glory, serve, and know. English can make this a little harder to observe, and I want to prepare you, I want you to be aware as we move forward through Exodus to discover these word patterns. I'm going to give you an example of what I'm talking about right now. Let's just take the recurring root word serve. I'll just do it in English for right now. Serve. It's going to change form and emphasis as we roll through Exodus. We're going to see the Hebrews move from servitude to the Pharaoh to service to God. When the Hebrews are given the Torah, they are also warned against serving other gods. The Torah also specifies how the Israelites, as the children of God, are to treat servants and how they are to conduct service in the tabernacle and how God is to be served. Now, this example is neither contrived and it's not allegorical or just a slick literary style. It's actually very typical. I'm taking you on this short detour to explain the significance of the unique and meaningful word structure of biblical Hebrew that takes a root word like serve, and then it molds it and it shapes it within the scriptures in a way that is particularly helpful for listening to as a spoken word, absorbing it through the ears, through hearing, than for memorizing it. See, these Hebrew word patterns are most useful in helping us to connect the dots. That is, we can follow thought patterns as God weaves and develops his creation in such an organic and intricate way, far beyond human ability to ever even conceive, let alone carry out. One concept is linked to the next, and then the next, and the next, forming a chain. Every tiny step is necessary, no matter how painfully long and drawn out it all might seem to us. And all this is done in the only way it can be done, in order for God to bring mankind from creation to a place of recreation and of a perfect unity with him, which is what he desires for us and what he's going to do. The foundation and structure of this divine plan and of this unchanging pattern, that's what we're going to find laid out for us in Exodus. So let's move on. I don't expect you to remember all that, only to make mental note of it so that the lights might come on from time to time as we spend the next many months in Exodus. So the Bible doesn't give us that much information about the 350 years that passed from the time of the Israelites entering Egypt until God starts preparing Moses to bring them out of Egypt. So I want to spend a few minutes painting as accurate of a setting as possible for the opening scenes of Exodus. Now, this information comes mostly from archaeological finds, as well as Egyptian and Greek and Roman historical records. The first one or two centuries that the Israelites spent in Egypt had been prosperous for them. All indications are that they lived comfortably, they lived peaceably. They had been allotted by the Pharaoh, thanks to Joseph, what was intended to be a permanent territory, perfectly suitable to their shepherd lifestyle in the land of Goshen. Goshen was in an area of Egypt called Lower Egypt, even though it lay at the northernmost area of Egypt. Noph was the capital city of Lower Egypt, and likely that is where Joseph was when he first dealt with his brothers who had come down to Egypt to acquire grain on account of the worldwide famine. However, new evidence gathered by people who expected anything but what they discovered is that Joseph also had a palace in the city where so many of the Israelites would live, a city called Avaris. This would seem most natural, as Joseph would have wanted to be close to his father and his brothers and his other Hebrew family members. Now, as might be imagined, not every Hebrew remained as a shepherd. Many took up the building trades. They learned them, no doubt, from the Egyptians because they excelled in architecture. Others became merchants, some even cattle ranchers, farmers. Again, they would have learned these occupations from some combination of the Egyptian nationals and the many foreigners that they would have come into contact with, since they lived in the very area that many foreigners from the area that we now call the Middle East would have to have passed through to get into Egypt proper. The Bible texts and scores of Egyptian monuments give every indication that the Hebrews were not restricted to only the land of Goshen, nor were they shy about moving into other areas of Egypt. They did. Over time, many Israelites became expert at growing crops, using the tremendous resources of the Nile to their advantage. Even more, they assimilated into Egyptian culture to varying degrees. Through everyday dealings with the native Egyptians and through intermarriage, Israel and Egypt fashioned quite a connection. Along with accepting Egyptian culture, they also began to adopt standard Egyptian religious views and religious rites. Sometime around the halfway mark of their sojourn in Egypt, a sea change occurred, and it forever altered the lives of the Israelites, beginning just a few decades before Joseph's arrival as a slave in Egypt. The so-called Hyksos rulers had established their dominance over most of Egypt, primarily Lower Egypt. The Hyksos were from somewhere in the Middle East. They were Semites, so they were cousins of Israel. And regardless of where they were from, they weren't Egyptians. They were foreigners. And the Egyptians detested being ruled by these shepherd kings, as they were known. Their dominance ebbed and flowed, at times making gains into Upper Egypt, which, by the way, is to the south, and the territory that lay between Upper and Lower Egypt, and inevitably losing some ground as well. Eventually, an Egyptian general in the capital of Upper Egypt, a city called Thebes, and by the way, that's now known as Luxor, gathered an army of Egyptian nationals, and they defeated these hated Hyksos rulers once and for all. Now, the Israelites would now become the focal point of nearly two centuries of bitterness that had built up in the Egyptian people that no doubt began when the Hebrew Joseph started accepting their servitude in exchange for food during that famous 7-year period of famine. The first job of the new king of Egypt then, an Egyptian, was to dismantle any foreign influence that could threaten Egypt. And that meant gaining control over these Israelites, whose numbers had grown into menacing proportions. Undoubtedly, the Israelites were the majority people in the Nile Delta areas, but they had also spread out and established themselves in other areas of Egypt. So the political solution was straightforward and very simple. Subjugate them. Make the Israelites into forced laborers. Now, for all practical purposes, we could say that there was a complete and almost overnight reversal of fortunes. The Israelites, who had become wealthy and numerous, they'd attained political clout in Egypt. Well, they were dispossessed. Overnight, they became the lower class. The Egyptians, who had been relegated to a lesser status than the Israelites for so long, they were now in charge. Now, while the idea of slavery is detestable to us, that doesn't necessarily mean, other than for a complete loss of freedom, that the slaves were necessarily poorly treated. In fact, most evidence is that except for their last few years in Egypt, the Hebrews were treated decently enough. We should not think of the Egyptian people as inherently cruel and uncouth. They were a high-minded people with deeply ingrained and refined morals and ethics. They were educated. They were intelligent. They were forward-looking. Besides, what use is a maimed or a dead slave? Well, despite what Cecil B. DeMille told the world in his famous remake of the Ten Commandments, the Israelites did not build pyramids. In fact, by the time of Jacob's arrival in Egypt, the pyramid building era was over. In fact, the Hebrews were not used as human lubricant under the rollers of 30-ton stone building blocks. Their work was as makers of mud bricks. They dug and restored waterways and canals. They helped build the great cities. The Israelites are most identified as the builders of the two great stores cities called Pitom and Ramesses. That's in the northern area of Goshen. And that, of course, is where the great Hebrew enclave of Avaris had been in existence beginning from a few years after the time of Joseph. A stores city simply meant it was a regional supply depot. It was a distribution center. In this case, these cities served both the civilian population and the Egyptian military, and they were strategically located in Goshen because it was the nearest to their eastern border and because that was a great food-growing region. Well, thanks to the brilliance of Egyptian science and culture and art and the tremendous skill and work ethic of the Israelites, even though it was forced work, Egypt became a world-class society. We could talk for days on end and examine these amazing civil engineering accomplishments of Egypt. That doesn't really fit our purpose. Suffice it to say that the grandeur of Egypt at its peak has not been surpassed to this very day, in my estimation. Well, the backward and poor society that is Egypt today bears no resemblance to the magnificent Egypt that existed in the time of Moses. Now, it is also good as a foundation for our study to understand that Egypt was the breadbasket of the world at this time. And what an irony that is, considering that their annual rainfall is almost non-existent. Rather, it's the function of the Nile that made Egypt such an incredible food machine. See, the Nile would overflow annually. It would deposit rich, fertile silt on the fields that surrounded its banks. Irrigation systems were built since time immemorial to water these fields, even before the time of the Israelites. Canals had been built such that their banks would overflow right along with the Niles. It was a way to expand the fields well beyond the Nile River, still taking advantage of all of its benefits. Well, sometime late in Joseph's career as the vizier of Egypt, several artificial lakes, reservoirs, were built for water storage. They used it in agriculture for the watering of these growing herds of cattle, which Egyptians preferred over sheep, and for household use for this expanding population of Egypt. In fact, there are waterways in Egypt named after Joseph, still in use today, still with Joseph's name attached. I'm going to conclude our introduction to Exodus by saying that at the time of the Israelites in Egypt, it was a land of plenty. It was a land of beauty and art. It was a land to be envied. When in Exodus we find the Israelites complaining of all their discomfort out in the wilderness of Sinai, we also hear them longing for their life back in Egypt. Not the forced labor part, of course, but the certainty of food and shelter and being part of a magnificent and familiar culture. And we will start Exodus chapter 1 next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.